Committee on General Government to order.
What was the matter?
Easy for you to say.
What'd he say?
It's okay.
Okay.
We made it, and we're here.
Well, I'm on the same tune then.
Okay, let's see. We are going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2739. I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2739. We have Representative Gilman here, and while he is on his way up, Patrick, if you would give us a little bit of a rundown of what we're doing with this one, okay?
I'd be glad to, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2739 directs state agencies to sell, exchange, convey, or lease all real property that is not needed for public use.
Okay. Representative Gilman, welcome.
Thank you. Representative Crummell and members, my name is George Gilman from District 55. I'm distributing a map to you that is just generally the Prineville area. A constituent came to me with this map, and I thought, if you'll notice, every one of these dark spaces is state-owned land. And if you'll take a look at 15 or 17 or 22, you'll notice they're right in subdivisions. I wonder why the state owns those lands. Looks to me like it'd be better to sell them and have them on the tax roll. That's why my deal changes may to shall. That's all it does. After the agency has done an assessment to be sure that they don't need the land in any foreseeable future, they should sell it. Not hang on to it and keep the local governments from having that revenue. So that's the long and the short of it. I'll point out number two up here. That happens to be Ochoco State Park. I have no intention, never will have an intention, to sell a state park or any land that's designated for park use. But if there's no real foreseeable need for that land, why not sell it? Be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions for Representative Gilman? Representative Gilman, do you have any idea, just on this map alone, how many acres might be represented by the dark spots?
I did not total it. I can give you this list. I'll make a copy and bring it back to the committee. But a lot of these parcels are several hundred acres, so it's a good-sized amount of land.
Okay.
And I want to point out that this just is around Prineville. I'm still working on how much is out there in the rest of my district, and I kind of invite you to look at your districts and see how much land the state owns and is not using.
Okay, thank you. One other question. Other than number two, we know is a state park. Do you know by any chance how many of these parcels are on a list to be used for something or other, or is that what you're getting at? Is it the assessment needs to be done and then?
Supposedly, right now, that our various departments and Division of State Lands. Division of State Lands, the one that owns most of these, are supposed to make that inventory. And then the law now says they may sell it. And I say they shall sell it.
Okay. Representative, thank you very much. Representative Mabry.
Representative Gilman, it says they should sell or exchange or lease all real property not needed for public use. Who is to make that determination, you know? I mean, who determines whether it's good for public use or not?
The determination of whether it's...
Whether it is has value for public use. I mean, obviously the state park would qualify. It's questionable whether or not a neighborhood subdivision would, but who makes that determination?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, at this time, I feel that the agency, Division of State Lands, Department of Transportation, and if you look at your maps, for your individual districts, you'll find that the Department of Transportation owns quite a little bit of land, too. I'm not advocating that most of that be sold. It's right-of-way land that they someday will anticipate there's a widening of a road or something like that. And then there's a lot of pieces that are not really very viable to be sold. And I'm not advocating they try to sell those either, because there wouldn't be any market for them.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Gilman, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, who did you say should make the decision? Who should make the decision on the land, the sale, lease?
I'm saying that the departments or divisions should make the decision of whether it's surplus or not. And I am not sure of the mechanism. I didn't want to get into this, but we just as well do it. I was talking to the Division of State Lands, and they informed me that they needed to hire another person to be able to sell these lands. And that's not my intention. I do not want to add additional state employees to do this. But when I have a piece of ground that I don't think I need anymore, I go to a real estate agent, and I have them between myself and they. We figure out a fair price, and we put it on the market. Is that so hard? Couldn't the state do that?
We probably have to write another law for that. Yes, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. I just want to be clear, good representative. Did you ask for a complete list of all our of all property owned by the state that was not currently being used?
Yes.
And you could not obtain one?
Well, I'm still working on it. It's coming. It's just it takes a while for the different agencies to, and that would be something else I'd encourage you, as I've already said, to ask for your own district how much surplus land there is available. I think you might be surprised.
But a follow-up, please.
Yes,
follow-up.
Representative Gilman, I'm just asking, is there not a list readily available of properties owned and being used by the state versus those owned and not being utilized? Is there not such a list in existence? Is all I want to know.
Hi, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. On this land that I've got here, I did get the list. The rest of my district, I have yet to get the list. So I can't tell you if there's a list available. I think there may be.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Brzezinski?
Thank you. Is there any mechanism that you think that we should have in place if we're going to move forward on this bill that would give directions to these agencies as to when they should be putting the property up for lease or for sale? My concern is, if we're in a soft market, would we be actually doing a disservice to the people of the state to be selling off property at a much lower value than what it actually may be worth?
I would, Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, this is a really good question. It's one of the things that we as individuals come up against, too. When do we sell and when don't we? I think that the state should sell when they really see they don't have a use for the land and not pay too much attention to the market. It's kind of like we did in the cattle business. When they were ready to go, we sold them. If you play that game of figuring out what the market's high and when it's low, you tend to lose in the long run. So I would think that once the decision's made that the surplus land, it should go on the market.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative, I have one more question. If you don't know the answer to this, it's not a. I'm sure that I can find out from DAS or DS Division of State Lands. But with regards to process, I know for a lot of the surplus properties, that the state owns, there's a particular process that they have to go through, and it involves making sure that they offer the property first to other government agencies that would be state agencies, and then to other government agencies that would be local government agencies, and then finally, after going through all of these things, finally getting to the private sector. Do you know, I didn't see anything in the bill that affected that process, and would it be a wise thing to try to put something in the bill to affect the process so that basically we would circumvent that and go directly to the private sector?
I did not address it, but I think it's an excellent thing, and I'd leave it to this committee to make that determination, Mr. Chair, because, yes, I think we ought to figure out a way, besides just saying that they shall do it, to expedite the process.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative, thank you. I don't have a list of anyone that wanted to testify on House Bill 2739. Is there anyone else that did want it? Jeanette, come on up. We're getting a little feedback, Gina. Can you adjust our volumes down or something? We're getting... Thanks. Whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was, for the record, I'm Jeanette Holman, the Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. I wasn't planning on testifying this morning, but I thought I could answer a couple of your questions that you might have. We've been talking to Representative Stillman, so this isn't a real surprise to us. The parcels he points out, many of them are owned by the Division of State Lands. Actually, some of them are common school fund lands, and that throws a little bit of another wrench into the formula. The land board is charged with maximizing revenues for the common school fund, and most of those properties on the map you have could be sold, and we would probably willingly do that. We do have to make sure that it's following the principles of sound investment for the common school fund, maximizing the income to the fund, both for today's children and tomorrow's children. We have a fiduciary responsibility as the whole managers of the trust. And so to Representative Prozanski's question about, you know, should we hold them or sell them, we would look at the market and, you know, take that into account. Our process is required to go through a bidding process, a public bid process on most properties. We have to open them for getting that. Some of our properties are common school fund lands. Some of them are other state lands that we've acquired through various ways, but most of them are common school fund land or bought with the proceeds of the sale of common school fund land, so which makes it falls within that constitutional trust responsibility. Most of our lands are being used. Most of them are either agricultural lands, many of the grazing lands in eastern Oregon. We have forest lands. We have some residential lands. But we are trying to look at some of our lands. We're trying to turn that kind of corner with the agency to be more active managers of our state trust lands. And to a large extent, some of that, you know, selling these properties, for example, in the residential areas, fits within that goal of trying to maximize the revenues. So just if you have any questions about state lands, I'd be glad to answer them, or I'd bring back our land sales expert at another hearing. But I did want to give you an opportunity to at least let me know what your questions were.
Thank you. Representative Kitts, did you have a question?
I did. First of all, I understand Representative Brzezinski's question. I think it's a fair question. And I think that Representative Gilman's response is even a better answer. And that is the state, in my opinion, and I think I would echo the sentiments of a lot of my colleagues, is the state should be confined by the same rules of real estate that that every Oregonian by whom those lands are owned. I consider those lands to be Oregon's lands. And my colleagues out here, my friends, my family, those are our lands. And if the state's not using those lands, it's my contention, and I do agree with Mr. Gilman, that they should be given back to the people or sold to the people, and without consideration of what the market at the time is. I mean, we as homeowners and home, you know, I'm going through the process right now myself. And regardless of the market being up or down, I will pass on that for the time being. Something like these lands here, can you tell me how long the state has owned them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, I don't know for sure. At the time we became a state, as part of the Admission Act to the state, we were given the 16th and 36th section of every township in the state to be used for common schools.
Is that what all
that may be
under?
What some of those are.
Some of them or all
yeah.
of them?
Or all of them, yeah. I don't know.
Okay.
Without looking specifically at those particular pieces of property, that may be what some of them are. And we don't have a problem with following the same rules of the market as the rest of Oregon, but we do also have that overlay of fiduciary responsibility, which any trustee would have in any trust situation.
Follow up,
Representative.
It's a great lanyard. Go Oregon State. Love the Beavs.
My son's student there. Thank you.
Any other questions for Jeanette? Representative Nelson?
Thank you. Jeanette, could you get us a list of the state-owned land? And, I mean, do you carry the composite for the entire state, or do we have to go to every single solitary agency and ask this question? You know, what do we own? You know, what agency utilizes it? What was the value? When was it bought? What's it used for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I don't want to weasel out of this question, but
oh, good.
There's a couple of agencies. DSL has all the land records from the beginning of statehood. We have, you come and visit us, we'll take you in our vault and show you, you know, these very old records. We also have a land mapping system where we keep track of our lands. The Department of Administrative Services is also the repository of a record for most of the rest of the state-owned lands. So probably between those two agencies, my guess is you'd get 90 to 95% of them and could probably get pretty close to a list. It may take some time. We'd have to, I think, pull them off of our land administration system, which is our computer GIS system, and translate that into a list, and I think that's probably what we're trying to do for Representative Gilman for the rest of his district. I think that we have been asked before, and I think that DAS has put together that list, so I don't think it would be too hard to get, but it might take asking both agencies.
Okay. Thank you. One other, was there any other questions for Jeanette? One other question that I do have, Jeanette, and that is relative to common school fund lands. My understanding is that one of the purposes of those lands is that if there was a school district in the immediate area, like for example on the map that Representative Gilman has given us, that a school district wanted to acquire for purposes of building a school on that, then they actually could submit a plan to DSL to purchase that property, and it would be sold to them at a reduced price. I don't know about being given to the school district, but can you help me understand what that is? Because I know we did have a process in Wilsonville for a piece of property that was turned over to the Westland Wilsonville Schools.
Right. Representative Kimmel, I don't know what the process is. I'd have to get back to you.
Okay.
But I think that it is true that we can either use the land itself for a school or we can sell it for the benefit of all schools. Let me get back to you because I don't know the real answer.
That would be fine. Thank you. Thank you, Jeanette. Is there any other anyone else that wish to testify on House Bill 2739?
Mr. Chair, is DAS here?
Yes, I believe that's John Wales back there. Good morning. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
record. My name is John Wales. I'm the manager of Real Property Services at the Department of Administrative Services, and I manage the leasing program and the property acquisition and sales program.
And did you have a question for him?
I sure do. thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wales, I am just... I can't believe we don't have a list of property that the state owns, I mean, that the taxpayers really own. And do you have such a list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, we have a list of properties of all the state, for all state agencies. We've actually just updated this database. And we have added a list or a field to this list of properties or candidate properties for surplus. We're responsible for when properties are surplus to act as a clearinghouse for the state agencies and go through that process that was mentioned earlier about first offering property to state agencies and then to the political subdivisions and then to the private sector. And we manage that process. We could put together a list quite quickly. I don't think we have one of all current surplus properties, although the ones that are on the market are up on the web page. We have a web page that that identifies those as well. But we could certainly poll the agencies and see which properties that they're intending to sell. We don't currently have that, but that could be put together very easily.
Follow up. Mr. Wales, you make me feel a lot better. I'm sure this is a lot of work, and Jeanette, I mean, she's probably relieved. and I understand that as a former administrator. But do you have a list of all owned property by the state?
Yes.
The value, when it was acquired, and what it's used for, plus that that's leased. My concern is because, you know, we just incurred a huge $12 million debt for moving an agency from Portland to here. And I'm just wondering why on earth we did that. Why didn't we trade partners, you know, or trade land with partners like, you know, whatever, Caldwell, whoever, 21st Century Real Estate, or whoever. And now I find out that there is land available to do that. But do you have a current list of all owned land, and plus the land that's leased and rented and who to? And then we can look at this and know it by either district or region or something and know what's for sale?
We have a list of all those property that state agencies own, and is divided up by location and acres, parcels. It is not does not keep track of value. The state has thousands of properties, and to keep property appraised at current market values is an enormous expense. So there's not the database does not include. Values. State lands may have estimates in their database, but in general, most state agencies don't keep track of the value. And primarily, the reason is that this, when the state acquires or owns property, it's not for investment purposes. It's for a public purpose. It's basically viewed as being kept for a long period of time, and so the actual value in every state piece of property isn't economic.
The last question, I'm concerned that, you know, there may be hundreds of thousands of acres that could be generating property taxes. And since I don't think you have that obligation, maybe one reason we don't know the assessed value. But you know the purchase value, right?
We know the purchase.
Yeah.
Representative Brzezinski and then Representative Kipps.
Thank you. I'm going to see if I can do better and just having a good question, see if I can get a better question this time. Regarding the process that's actually used by DAS, it's my understanding from talking to other agencies, there's actually a continual process of evaluating land on some regular frequent basis to determine whether or not that land is necessary for that department, agency, fulfilling whatever mission, and that, as you've mentioned, they actually are putting stuff on the market on a somewhat of a regular basis. Could you maybe explain a little bit how that process actually works, if you know, so maybe we would be a little bit more enlightened as to what steps agencies are in fact taking regarding surplus property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski. The process that every agency goes through the determination, the process of determining whether certain property is needed for their individual programs, and they make that determination. When that happens, our agency, DAS, is notified that they would like to proceed and dispose of a property. We then run a service of clearinghouse for the purpose of first checking other state agencies to make sure there's not another agency out there looking to buy a piece of property that this particular property would meet that need. And that's the real basis for that. That process takes about 30 days to sort through. If no other agency is interested, then we survey the political subdivisions, the city, county, school districts in the community to see if there's an interest, in the property. And if the answer is no to that, then the agency or DAS, depending on who has a jurisdiction on the property, will position the property and put it into the market for sale.
Thank you. If I can follow up.
Follow up.
I guess first a comment. I know that this process actually does work. At least ODOT had a piece of property in Eugene where the Prefontaine Memorial is at, and I know that they work very closely with the city of Eugene to determine whether it can be transferred or managed by the city as a memorial park. Representative Kitts brought up a point as to having access to the property. Do you know if there's any procedure where we have state lands that we make it open and accessible to the general public to maybe use those parcels of land for recreation purposes or other, say, non-homesteading type of purposes?
Yes, the Department of Forestry and Parks and Rec all have properties that are made available to the public. I can't speak for state lands. I believe there are some arrangements there. I think it is really dependent on agency by agency and on the property specific piece of property. But to answer your question, there are properties that are available. Okay. I think it depends on the agency and which properties.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kitts, and then Representative Mabry.
Well, I'm glad to see that the good representative has risen to the level of great questions. I'm now going to provide an example of an excellent one. Can you explain to me one more time the process? You're saying that, and this is new to me, the state lands owns it. When they decide they're going to sell it, they then offer it to X, Y, and then the public? What were the two?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, are you talking about the state lands division, or are you just talking about state properties?
Well, when the state properties go out to bid, you had a sequence of before it gets to the public. I would appreciate if you could reiterate that for me.
Fine. The sequence is that there is a requirement to check internally with other state agencies to verify that there's not a need for that particular property, and the reason for that is to make sure that another state agency isn't buying a piece of property over here when this piece of property that this agency would like to sell over here. And so that's
right here.
Yeah.
I got a question. I'm about to come back and I'll forget it. So would the state agency sell this property to another state agency, or would they swap it? Would they give it to them since the state already owns it? How does that – I mean, it seems like if I'm understanding correctly, we're going from one taxpayer entity selling it to another taxpayer entity before this taxpayer entity may go buy something else with taxpayer dollars. Is that fair?
That could happen. Yeah, that's a fair assessment. That's the intent.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Mabry?
First of all, let me just say that, you know, just because there's a black spot on a map doesn't make that good, bad, or indifferent. And that was led to my question about who determines whether it's of good use. I don't think there's anything sinister about the state owning a piece of property by any means. But some of these black spots on the map do beg the question of why is the state holding on to them. As a former county executive, I know one of the many problems we had with publicly owned lands, state and federal lands both, was, because there weren't dollars to deal with the issue, noxious weeds became a real problem to our farm community because they weren't managed correctly. And I suspect, I mean, you know, looking at the legend, this one black spot looks like it's a mile by a mile or somewhere in that. That's a fair-sized piece of property. I suspect that some of those may not be managed, therefore contributing to part of the problem the agriculture community has with trying to manage noxious weeds. In many cases, they're mandated by the state that they manage noxious weeds, but the public doesn't do that. So my question, I guess, is there any thing in place? I wouldn't want just anybody to be able to demand that there's no public use for this land. I mean, somebody needs to make that determination. But is there anything in place that would allow a city or a county or a special district or someone to say, I think parcel 17 no longer has any value to the state. Would you consider putting that on the market and start that process? Because I know my own tendency, and I think I'm not that much different than human nature, out of sight, out of mind, you're not thinking about it, so it's not very high on somebody's agenda, and besides that, you're working anyway. But is there some stimulus that would allow local communities to say, would you consider selling parcel 17?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mayberg, the answer is yes. Routinely, communities and private individuals approach my agency or the specific agency that owns the property and inquire about the status of the property and whether it is a candidate for surplus or has been surplus. And at that point, it's treated individually. Whatever agency owns the property and manages the property has the responsibility to evaluate that request and look at the and answer that question. And there isn't a formal process for that, but that is an open that opportunity exists and it happens on a routine basis.
Representative Nelson, you have one more question?
Yes, sir. Last question. Not thinking of the state as a real estate rental company. I have been amazed in looking at the budgets that your increase for charges to the agencies are users. Is that a good word?
Tenants in?
The increase that you're charging for all the agencies, as far as their rent, in line of this, critical budget season. And I'm just wondering, what that almost up to 5.5% in some cases rent escalation is based on, and I'm concerned about it and wonder if all those previous renters are current.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm just to clarify the question, you're referring to the rent that DAS would charge to agencies in DAS-owned buildings, that increase that it went from it's going to $1.30 a square foot, is that what you're referring to?
It's beyond that in some cases, up to $1.60.
In a DAS-owned building? DAS has a unit?
No, I don't call it DAS-owned because it's a state of Oregon to me.
Okay.
So that's why I was wondering.
I can speak to the uniform rent program, which DAS charges agencies for buildings that it owns. That rate has gone to $1.30 for the next biennium. There may be other agencies that own buildings that are charging a higher rent that we don't control at DAS. Those rents are set by each individual agency if they own the property. But for, I don't know if you had a specific building in mind.
That's okay. I'll get with y'all later.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Avakian, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you comment on the specific bill that's before us and tell us what you think about the changing of the word may, which would be discretionary for an agency to sell, changing it to shall, dictating that they must sell certain properties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, When DAS reviewed this bill, we did not see any impact, fiscal impact to DAS in making that change. Our policy is that has and always has been that when a building or a property is declared surplus, we sell it. We put it into the market. So we don't see that there is a, for DAS properties, that there was a significant change. Having said that, or maybe I should just preface it that the statute, the policy that at the beginning of the statute clearly states that it will be the policy of the state not to hold any more property than is needed, and that when it is no longer needed, that we put it back on the tax rolls. And that's the guiding principle for the whole disposition program. So at DAS, that's our position, and that's how we proceed. Having said that, we assume that most agencies or all agencies go through that same discretion and drill in making that making those decisions. We at DAS don't control those decisions for every agency, and every agency is responsible for looking at their programs and what real estate is needed to operate those programs. But once they've made that decision, then we assist in the process of disposing of the property. The only comment that we made at DAS on that bill by changing it from may to shall is you are, and I think that's the intent, removing discretion as to whether that property will or will not be sold. And we would just caution that there may be some properties that may cost more to dispose of than to hang on to, and we just want to think that through and be careful on the wording so that not everything was sold. There may be some properties, for example, where there's a debt service on a property that may exceed the value at this particular time, or that there may be property that needs to be all the land rights aren't fully understood and would need some cleaning up, so to speak, before the property could be sold. Some pieces, because the state, as you know, has some kind of strange parcels, may not have access to them, and so certain positioning and certain issues may need to be addressed before the property can be sold. And we would just caution that we don't want to incur more of a cost in disposing of the property. And I don't think that's the rule of thumb, but that is something that we should be thinking about.
Okay. Thank you. Before I close the public hearing on this, John, I would like to ask if you could work with Representative Gilman to address a couple of the issues that you were just talking about, and also then maybe work with Patrick, because I think that something about the process, if we can, for expediting it, I would like to see us do that, and then and maybe, you know, where it's applicable and where it's practicable, I think that kind of language should definitely be in there, because there's going to be cases where it's not where it's neither applicable or practical to sell a property, and I want to make sure that we don't trap an agency in something that, you know, they've got to get rid of surplus properties, but there's other properties that, you know, even though they're not necessarily being used, they're not qualified, they don't qualify as surplus, but yet sort of get caught in this bill. And if can I impose on you to do that, and then once we've done that, then I can bring this back at another time for a work session.
Sure.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it. And maybe work with Jeanette on that too, from a standpoint of what the DSL needs and everything are. I'd appreciate it. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2739. Members and the audience, just to give you an idea of where we're going, we're going to go to House Bill 2974 next, and then after that, immediately after that, we'll go to House Bill 3101, and then we'll clean up with 3062 and then 3060. So just so you know where we're going on the agenda, and we do need to move through our agenda as quickly as we can, because 10 o'clock and later will be upon us very quickly if we're not careful. So with that, I'm going to open a public public hearing on House Bill 2974. And would you go ahead and give us a rundown on this one, please, Patrick? And did you want to testify?
I was going to interview you on the introduction.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be good.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2974 exempts war veterans' discharge papers that have been filed with the county clerk from disclosure requirements.
Okay, thank you. And we have with us the usually distinguished and asks good questions, Representative Pozanski.
Mr. Chair, I've not met Mr. Wayne Schultz. He is a constituent of mine who asked us for this bill to be drafted. I'm wondering if you can go ahead and call him up. So
oh, sure. That would be fine. If Wayne Schultz, would you go ahead and come on up, please? Representative, I'm sorry. Whenever you're ready, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, Floyd Przonski, House District 8. Seated to my left is Wayne Schultz, a veteran who lives in Eugene in my district. He had contacted my office wanting to know if I could assist him in having a bill drafted, which has resulted in HB 2974. The purpose of the bill is to provide for the opportunity for war veterans to exempt discharge papers that have been filed with county clerks from disclosure. I am going to let Mr. Schultz review the issue with you as to his concerns and the needs as to why this should happen. I do feel that I do need to also put on the record that I have heard mixed responses to the bill, and I know that there is going to be some individuals that will be testifying as to raising some concerns. So I just wanted to give an opportunity for the committee to know that there will be, I guess, a different perspective than what we may hear.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing House Bill 2974 today. And as you already know, I'm Wayne Schultz from Eugene, Oregon. This bill protects veterans' discharge papers that have been filed with a county clerk from general public disclosure, which greatly reduces the chances of identity theft. And over the years, many people separating from the military service have been advised to file their separation papers with a county clerk so that if they ever lost the original, they would have a valid copy to back up as a backup. But unfortunately, in recent years, identity theft has become an increasing problem, and now those people who have recorded their records are vulnerable. When I found out this was a problem, I contacted the Lane County clerk to have my retirement papers removed from the record and was told there was no legal mechanism to do this, and that's why I requested this legislation. House Bill 2974 does not remove the document from the record, but it does restrict access to only those people who have a really valid need to know. It affords protection not only to people separating from active duty, but also reservists, people coming out of the National Guard and Coast Guardsmen. There have been a number of identity thefts and reported cases of people getting their hands on thousands of copies of these retirement papers. And really, it doesn't take very much to steal somebody's identity. According to what I've read, all you need is a birth date, a social security number, and address, and you've got everything you need. And, of course, this can lead to things like credit card fraud, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. After that, they can purchase expensive property, cars, houses. They can do it all over in diverse geographical areas. They sell identities to other people, including illegal aliens. And once somebody becomes a victim of this, it can last for a long time. Clearing it up can take a long time. And I've read where law enforcement people have told victims that they might as well count on having problems for the rest of their lives. So I sincerely hope you pass this bill. It's a significant weapon in the battle against identity theft and will provide protection to all those who have filed their discharge papers. And on behalf of all Oregon veterans, thank you for hearing this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Are there any questions for Mr. Schultz? Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Schultz, and thank you for serving our country. I'm just concerned that there might be a case where certain individuals would need access to your records, i.e., family members after an end of, not you, but some other veterans should decease certain records, maybe for some type of research regarding family. Do you have any concern about those types of situations being included as exceptions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, you mean my concern that there's too much available the way the bill's written?
No, that someone might,
might need it.
A funeral director. I don't mean to be, you know, bad about it.
Morbid,
but could happen. I'm thinking of my own father, for example.
Right.
Would you want to make those exceptions in this bill?
Well, there are some exceptions already in the bill that I think are fairly that are adequate, I believe. War veterans whose name appears on the discharge paper can be released only to the war veteran whose name appears on the discharge papers, and if they're deceased, a personal representative or a service officer appointed under ORS 408.410 or the Department of Veteran Affairs, and any person with written authorization from the veteran or their personal representative if they're deceased.
Follow up. I guess I'm just assuming that all individuals do not have a personal representative. As has been the case in my family, for example, individuals, friends. And I'm just wondering if we could allow those for certain reasons, like burial, certain types of genealogical research that might be requested to for others later to claim identity, i.e., Native American heritage, those sort of things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I wouldn't have any, personally any objection to anything like that. What I'm really concerned about and worried about right now is it's just wide open to everybody.
Sure.
And there's nothing we can do about it. Those of us who have filed have no protection whatsoever. So if we can, I'd like to at least make it safer, even if we can't make it completely safe.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Schultz?
Mr. Schultz, thank you very much. Let's see. I would like to have John Mangus and Charles Stern. If I can just have you both come up as a panel, I would appreciate it. And since you both are sort of neutral, I thought it would be okay to put you at the table together and you wouldn't duke it out. So,
absolutely. Go ahead.
Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, John Mangus, Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs. We haven't taken a position on House Bill 2974. Identity theft is an issue nationwide for a lot of reasons. And through a lot of the veteran organization literature in the last 18 months, there's been a number of articles written on identity theft and encouraging veterans to not record their discharge or actually their DD Form 214, or if they can, to get it unrecorded, which you can do. We checked on that with the Justice Department, and to our knowledge, there has not been one case of identity fraud reported in Oregon as a result of somebody taking information from the DD Form 214. We, in turn, published information on that in our veterans newsletter that goes out to roughly 66,000 veterans in Oregon. We do know it's a problem, but here in Oregon, we've been encouraging people. Oregon law provides for a veteran, a war veteran, to be able to record their discharge at the county courthouse at no cost and to obtain copies of that document should they be required in the future. And the department, we've been encouraging veterans to record their separation documents since 1945. As veterans are probably the worst people when it comes to protecting documents that are seemingly important at some time in your life. And, you know, we probably receive just at our office, two or three inquiries a day, either directly from a veteran, a survivor of a veteran, or a funeral director trying to obtain a copy of the person's separation papers for some type of a benefit. In the case of a funeral director, it's to, because the veteran has passed away, and they're trying to get that person buried in a national cemetery, and the national cemetery is not going to allow access until they can establish that that person does qualify under federal law. And so the first thing we do to, you know, is try to question the person to find out if they lived in Oregon at the time of enlistment in the service or came back to Oregon at the time of separation. Did they record their D-Form 214? In that case, we call the county or the county veteran service officer, ask them to go over and see if they get a copy of it and send it to us or fax it to us, and we get that issue taken care of. If they didn't record it, then the only thing you can do is submit a federal standard form 180 to the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis and wait up to 6 months for that document to be returned if it can be obtained. You have to remember the National Personnel Records Center in 1974 burned, and there were hundreds of thousands of records that were destroyed. So in some cases, the only document is the recorded document somewhere in some state. I think, you know, it's 2974, I think, is trying to find a solution to a problem that doesn't yet exist with the DD Form 214. The problem, to me, seemingly, would be if you're going to steal somebody's identity, that you would go for financial documents. And there are a number of cases. Here's an individual that sold 30,000 names for $30. And this was a teledata communications company. Another 750,000 people suffered the consequences when they, at Ford Motor Company, when the payroll system was released. 265,000 California state employees compromised when their payroll system was allowed to be delivered. And Key Bank, or no, Bank One, 250 stolen records, and they only told the individuals 8 months after the fact. You know, it's people want credit card information, social security numbers, date of birth. You can get social security and date of birth off of DD Form 214, but that's really it. As far as an address, they have an address, you know, your home or record at time of entry into the service, and they'll have a mailing address at time of separation. The home or record, generally, you know, that's the way we move around in this society. That's not valid any longer. And your mailing address at time of separation, it's, if you're just a one-term enlistment or a period, is probably your parents' address in most cases. A little bit different if you're talking about Guard and Reserve and that. But we don't take a position on it. It just seems like it's with the DD Form 214, it's not a big issue. It creates a bigger problem for these people on trying to separate military separation document recordings from other documents that are recorded, and probably expensive, and probably if the state says do it, the state's going to pay for it. And,
okay.
They probably don't care, but somebody else is going to pay the freight.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Charles?
Mr. Chair, my name is Charles Stern. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I chair the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee. I've given you some written testimony from myself. There's also a little document put together by the Marion County Director of Elections, Phil Miles. And I've also provided a copy of the fine newspaper produced by the gentleman beside me called Vets News, in which the article appears that he has referred to on page 8. The recorders, clerks, share some of the concern the vets have expressed. There's a lot of personal information in public records. And that's a concern for everybody, as identity theft, people, the issue of stalkers, that's been raised. There's all kinds of issues you can raise over the personal information that can come from public records. To this, our knowledge to this day, nobody has created an identity from the public records, be they DD-214s or other public records that's in the recorder's office. I attended a seminar in Washington, D.C. in February, in which was entirely focused around privacy. It's a big issue. And you've got a number of bills that are coming to you dealing with Social Security, personal identifiable information, and they're all in this kind of the same scope of how do we deal with it? And I'll tell you how to deal with it. I don't know. But it's something that we've all talked about, we've looked at, and probably as we move along through, we'll have to somehow come together on a way to deal with it. But at this point, I mean, I spent several days back there, and the answers were, it's a problem. But we don't know what the problem is, because even the privacy advocates that were on the panel said they had no evidence that identity was taken from any of the public records or land records. Mostly it's dumpster diving and mailbox theft. That's where the bulk of it comes from. Anyway, but look, go back to this bill, which I think we have to look in that bigger picture of personal identifiable information, which you or some other committee, and you may be on one of those other committees, it's out here. You know, you've got several bills dealing with it. And but some issues that, in particularly this bill, I think we need to look at documents that may have been recorded prior to this act and those documents that may be recorded after the act, how they can be dealt with differently. If this bill is to move forward, where DD-214 records or discharge records are mingled with land records. I did an email poll to my clerks yesterday, and I only have 5 counties that reported back to me they maintain them separately. All the rest are mingled with land records. This bill, as written, would close land records. And so there may be other organizations that have concerns about that. It'll certainly have an impact on banking, real estate, mm-hmm. some of those other areas. Representative Nelson pointed out that the bill really didn't provide access for the funeral director or for family members. And then I would certainly suggest that you need to be able to provide genealogical research after at least 75 years should be a wide open record for that type of research. And that 75 years often used through the statutes, both state and federal, to open what may be public records, but to private to the public for genealogical research. Anyway, big first concern is the closing of land records in all but about 5 counties, and most of those are smaller counties. The cost of creating separation, because most of these are stored on microfilm, there's a number of counties are imaging today, but all these old records are on film, and mixed in with land records, the index is all pointing to a roll of film, which will happen. So that, can it be done? Yeah, absolutely. But there's a price to pay to do that. And so that would be an issue that the counties would want to have addressed. In the last 10 years, Washington County has reported they record over 1 million records, and they figure there's about 1,000 discharge records scattered through that that they would be having to remove. Anyway, so I urge you to consider the impacts of the bill. We're certainly maybe back here talking again about personal identifiable information on another bill, and we'll be open to helping in whatever way.
I just have one quick question, Charles. If we were to amend the bill so as to allow removal at the request of a veteran, what kind of Pandora's box would we open?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, these records are stored on microfilm. They will be not only in our custody, but they're also in title companies in various other places who buy copies of our microfilm. So we'd have to look at that whole scope of things. But again, there's a price to that.
Okay. Okay, thank you. One question, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Director Mangus and County Clerk Stern. Could I just ask you, Mr. Stern, could I come to your office and ask for a copy of Mr. Mangus, DD-14?
I don't think you could because I don't think I have one, but you could ask for one that would be there.
Okay.
At this point, it is a public record, yes.
Even I'm not related, I could just get it?
That is correct. It's a public record currently.
So no requirement for any identification on my part. No.
But you could also ask for a copy of a marriage record or a lien record, which would also have Social Security number and a more current address. A marriage record would have your mother's maiden name, which you use for a password at your bank. We have a number of records with personal information. I think you have to look at the big picture of the personal identifying information.
And please
make it quick.
Thank you, Chair Cummel. You know, the DMV, we had such a problem with them in the last session, and so they now have the opt-out, or they have the opt-out service. You know, so that the list of DMV, you know, you could opt out of it. Now they have the opt-in. If you want your name to be sent out, they were sending it out, and they were selling the list. I'm concerned about this. They were selling the list at $700 or $800 a piece of all those who had license. And do you do that? Do you sell for a fee these veterans' information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the answer is yes and no. The land title buy everything that we record every day. So they maintain their plant with that information. For those counties that have it mingled, in that case, that was sold right along with it. For the counties that maintain them in separate records, the answer is no. I do not know of any county that has sold DD-214 information as DD-24 information. It would be sold as a part of this bulk package to a title plant or a film plant that is servicing a title plant.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Tom, did you have something? Tom Gallagher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Gallagher, representing the newspaper publishers. And I have a tougher piece of the presentation to you, which is to talk a little bit about why we have the whole public records law in the first place, why we have all the transactions or actions taken by public bodies that are subject to public scrutiny through the public records law. Whenever these bills come up, we end up having to go back in and talk to a committee about the reasons that we have the public records law in the first place. The bill in front of you presents one of the more difficult ways to start into it, because what you're focused on is the very good concerns of the representatives that their records could be used for an illegal purpose. And what I have to ask you to do is to think of yourselves as the first balancing test on the public records law. If you go in and you move something out of public records, you exempt it from public records, you have to have a pretty good reason. The bill we're spending the most time on this session is the security plans for terrorism. And there's been work groups all through the summer. The Attorney General's involved. It's in the Judiciary Committee. There are cities, counties, and others involved. While we very carefully go through and find a way to exempt precisely the kinds of records that need to be exempted for the protection of the general public and avoid exempting other records that don't need to be. And all of the myriads of people that use public records in very many different ways. I thought that Representative Nelson asked a good question. Can I just go in and get somebody else's public record? The problem with asking the question that way is, how do you begin to exclude access to public record by class or category? If it's a public record, that's what it means. It's a public record. Now you're into the First Amendment. And just for an example, in the terrorism bill, well, who's if somebody requests a public record and they look suspicious, can you deny them the public record? If they act suspicious, if they have a foreign name, can you deny them the public record? That's a whole different area of law to get into. That's First Amendment and very complicated. I listened very carefully as to why the proponents of the bill wanted to be excluded, and they have a general fear, not a specific fear. If there's a specific fear, a specific action, most of the time we can find a way to use part of the existing public records or craft around it. A general fear of identity theft really shouldn't be solved piece by piece by piece. It should be solved as a public policy question on how are we going to deal with identity theft. I sat in on bills on credit cards and how credit card records are going to be changed and maintained so that the dumpster diving doesn't occur. I listened to the other experts come in and testify as to how these records can be accessed or used. So I would just leave you with this admonition on doing anything to change the public records law. Remember the bigger and general principle when you start with. Why do we have the public records law in the first place? And does this specific exemption rise to the level where the balancing test of public good versus the individual good gets tipped over by the individual good? If you don't continually keep that test in front of you, we will piece by piece by piece dismantle the public record law. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Gallagher?
I could just ask one quick one.
One quick one. That's it.
Mr. Gallagher, you know, you bring up a very, very good point I had not thought of in thinking about this bill. Is, you know, I almost cannot think of anybody more in need of protection than a veteran when it comes to terrorism, i.e., you know, those individuals who right now are in Iraq, you know, fighting for our country, for the freedom of the Iraqi citizens. And I could see where some terrorists would want access of who was involved in that, you know, issue or that war. And it could be for the you know, need, veterans could need protection for that. Just wanted to throw that out, and I'll get out of here, but I had a good point I hadn't thought of.
Mr. Chair, my response to that is we sat for hours trying to figure out all the targets the terrorists could get at. They're just innumerable, all the different ways that the fear that you raise could be. And if we start changing all of our laws and all of our privacy laws and all of our general public freedom of movement and all the other good benefits of this civilization, this society, because of all the could-bes, it would be a long session.
I couldn't agree more. And the terrorists will have won. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2974. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3101. And, Patrick, you want to give us a rundown on this? And Representative Close, when she comes in, I'm going to interrupt everybody.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Mr. Chair, House Bill 3101 directs public libraries to install filtering software on library computer terminals that provide internet access to the public. Included in your packets is a newspaper article that was submitted by staff from Representative Close. So you'll notice that there in your packets.
Okay, thank you. one second here. She's a requester? Okay. I'm going to call you up in panels, and then when I and when Representative Close gets here, I'm going to kind of separate the panel and have her go ahead and speak. So I understand that Ms. Brownlow, are you the requester of the bill? I'd like to have you come up along with Robert Ekstrom and Norma Rich. Thank you. Ms. Brownlee, since you're the or Brownlow, I'm sorry, since you're the requester, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and start.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Suzanne Brownlow, and I'm a mother of four. I live in Clackamas County. I used to be the state director of Concerned Women for America of Oregon, but I still remained very involved in issues that are about the families. And one problem that I see is walking into the library and having to shield my children from something their little innocent eyes might see. Here I go. Every time I talk about my kids, I get very emotional because it's a mother's duty to protect their children. And the filters that I'm asking for are very successful, and there have been 40% of the libraries across the nation in, let's see, was that 2001, are using filters.
Can you turn that microphone just a little bit that way? There, thank you.
Okay. So it jumped from like 24%. It's in my huge packet that I gave you. In 1 year, it jumped from like 20.
Prepared.
I know. I did this last night. From like 27% to 43% of the libraries using filters in just 1 year. So I know by this year, I'm sure a lot of them are using it. And I think Oregon children deserve to be protected in the libraries. And one of the reasons we want filters is not only for the protection of children, but the fact that pedophiles and sex offenders will use the library to come in and download obscene and illegal pornography. And I have in here, you know, I don't really want to go into what exactly is on the internet because my child's here and it's graphic, but it is way worse than anybody could ever imagine. It has gone way past Playboy. And the filters work. We want to protect children. I think it's the duty of government to protect citizenry, and especially children. Businesses have standards of decency. Most businesses I know have a rule: no downloading of pornography. Why? Because it's offensive to other people. It destroys a community. People become addicted to pornography. They act out pornography. They commit crimes. Recently, Les, I think that might have been something Representative Close gave you, the article about the 9-year-old girl. Her cousin was looking at pornography. She told him to get off of it, and he went into a rage. He beat her up, raped her. He was seen walking down the street in Salem with her naked body, her draped, she was passed out, I think, draped over his shoulder. And time after time, the prisons are filled with sex offenders that have used pornography. So why should a government institution provide freely to this filth, you know, using our tax dollars? I'm sure all of you are aware that the Multnomah County Library was part of the suit to overturn the Child Internet Protection Act. It's in the Supreme Court right now. It should get a decision in July, and they say that it should pass. And what this act does is it requires all libraries that receive federal money to install filters, porn blocking filters. So it's definitely something that I think that we should do is to protect children, not use our tax dollars to provide illegal pornography, and not produce material that that breeds sex perverts, sexual predators.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Barkin.
The bill specifically says that offensive material includes adult-oriented, sexually explicit internet sites.
Mm-hmm.
What would your feeling about the bill be if instead of that language it said something to the effect of material that incites illegal behavior?
Well, we didn't...
And when the other folks testify, I'd be curious of your thoughts on that as well.
Okay. Chairman, Representative Avakian, we were hoping to change the word offensive to be material that has been deemed harmful to children. That has already been defined in courts, what that involves. material that has been deemed harmful to children. And also, we were hoping to include some sort of penalty to a library that doesn't comply. We didn't get a chance to work on that bill, but we're hoping to that if a library does not install these filters, that they would not receive state money or some.
And in your mind, Mr. Chair,
Representative Buckin,
in my lap, who in your mind would decide which would be being harmful, which content would be being harmful?
Well, it's already it's in one of the documents that I have in my packet. There is a Supreme Court citing, I believe, and it defined what is a material that is deemed harmful to children.
Versus Miller in California.
What is it?
There was one versus Miller in California.
Okay. I'm sorry I didn't number my pages. I know. We just put this together.
Okay.
I don't want to
get into trying to amend the bill right here while we're talking about it in committee, but I think you understand, and you understand what she's pointing to, Representative. Is that sufficient? Answer or
no, but I don't think we need to get into it right now.
Thank you.
Okay, and the library should not be a place that we have to shield our children from this obscenity, illegal pornography, child abuse. I can't go into detail, but it's there. There was a Google search on the internet, turned up 244,000 sites discussing zoophiles. That's
discussing what?
Zoophiles. That's a new.
I'm going to ask what one of what
people, those are. People that have sex with animals.
Yeah.
Just to show you how
games?
Much they have.
Yeah.
They call them zoophiles.
Yeah.
244,000 sites.
Okay. What I need to bring this back because we are going to run out of time, and I have two other bills that we've got to get to. Okay. So I need you to go ahead and wrap up, if you would, please. And if you would, members, just hold on to your questions until we get to until this panel is finished, and then I'll ask for questions. Mr. Ekstrom, I'm sorry. You have one other point you'd like to make?
Yes, one point. The libraries may say this is censorship, but only the federal government can censor, and that is prohibit the publication of material. And if every library would have everything there is ever written and did not exercise judgment in what they were going to have in the library, then every library would be as big as the Library of Congress. So it is not reasonable to expect to have everything that there is ever printed or everything there is ever allowed passing through the internet. So we are saying it's exercising judgment. As they exercise judgment when they determine, can we afford this book? Do they need another one of these kind of books? Should we shelf this in the adult section or should it be the children's section? It's just exercising judgment as to what access children can have on the internet. And can I say, I did have a personal experience with, I was in the Clackamas County Library one day with my children, and this was a library that was supposed to be using filters on children's only, but I don't think they have it now because I talked to Commissioner Larry Sowa, and he said they don't use filters. But they have a policy where you're supposed to sign a document that says, I will not download anything graphic, sexually graphic. And my point is, it doesn't work, the policy, expecting people to be honest, because I was there one day in the children's section. I heard some men laughing. And I turned to look and see what was going on. Three men sitting around children's computer, and their little toddlers walking around. And there was, I looked at the screen, and it was hardcore pornography. And I said, being the mother bear that I am, what are you doing? You're not supposed to have that on. Get that off. You have children in here. And they, you know, turned it off. But we can't rely on people. You can't just trust people to not download stuff. And teenagers will look into this stuff. And it's just, I don't know.
Thank you. Mr. Ekstrom.
Good morning. Appreciate the work that you folks do. Thought I might encourage you with a quote from a gentleman who was a member of Parliament, early 20th century England. He said, half the lies our enemies tell about us aren't true. So that might encourage you guys. What I want to say in regards to House Bill 3101, I have given a printed sheet to you, but just this morning I'd like to say America's enemies accuse us of being outwardly powerful but inwardly corrupt. I wonder, and I say this with regard to this particular bill in front of you, that at a moment when our overpowering military resources are being used to free Iraqis from a man like Saddam Hussein, do we have the will to protect the children within our own country from the pornographic onslaught that would destroy their minds and hearts? Well, do we? I ask, what is our military fighting for? Is it for the right of pornographers to access our children? Or are we fighting for the right of children to grow up protected from weapons of moral mass destruction? What I prepared for you might be considered to be kind of the devil's advocate kind of comments, or the kind of things that citizens may not say here, but are saying around their water coolers regarding efforts like the one this bill is trying to make and the response we often get down here in Salem. There are several reasons to give this bill polite but passing treatment. They are, number one, nobody seriously expects House Bill 3101 to go anywhere, even though none of us would allow our own children to sit down at a computer and scan through pornography. Number two, this is Oregon. There is really nothing innocent or decent left to protect. So why bother acting as if there is? Number three, these citizens who try to connect their paying of taxes with the idea that funded services should be respectful of their sensibilities are nice folks, but they just don't get it. Number four, you'll see, is missing. This bill's about censorship. My wife censored that one. Number five, it seems like the right thing to do, but it would burn up too much political capital to make it happen here. Number six, if we give the moral maniacs an inch, they'll try to take a mile. It's safer to give them nothing. Number seven, the librarians are politically organized, well linked with other organized political employees, and they give money to legislative candidates who won't stray off the reservation.
They do?
We all know that average citizens don't give money.
They don't?
Number eight, the courts would just throw it out anyway, and so on and so on. But there is, however, at least one reason for each of you legislators to put everything you've got behind House Bill 3101 and insist on its passage. And it is this: you will have stood between a child and that which would degrade and twist his or her mind. I ask you, what is that worth? Recently, a bill just flew through this legislature. I think it was H.J.R. 6, the bill that patted the school-based clinics on the back and memorialized them with February being the month for remembering the good that school-based clinics do. It may not have been H.J.R. 6, but that did occur here, and you probably all know about it. It just flew through this legislature. This bill should fly through even faster by rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rich, I'm going to have you hang on just a second. We have Representative Close is here, and I would like to just have her go ahead and come up. And Representative, did you have a statement you wanted to make?
I appreciate the courtesy, Representative Crummell. First, I want to commend you for Chair Cromwell for hearing the bill. As you heard in the former testimony, this is a controversial subject, and it takes courage to even have hearings on these types of bills because you have to deal with a barrage of criticism. So I appreciate your willingness to hear it, and for all the committee's willingness to hear both sides of this issue. Thank you for hearing House Bill 3101. The bill would direct libraries to install filtering software on library computer terminals that provide internet access to the public. I have sponsored the bill at the request of Concerned Women for America and several constituents in my district who are alarmed at what they are seeing in public libraries. As a mother of four children, I became concerned about internet pornography at public libraries when I saw a television news story about the issue. It was reported that adults are pulling up pornographic images at public libraries and printing them there off the internet. They were then taking the material into library bathrooms, which children also use. The opportunity this gives to sexual predators seems obvious and dangerous. Printed images were also found on the ground outside the libraries. I myself have installed internet filtering on my home computer. I trust my four children completely, but they have found that pornographic images tend to pop up without any intent to find them. The purveyors of pornography are insidious, and they will stop at nothing to gain access to our homes and libraries. Because libraries use taxpayer money, I think it's important to protect the public at public institutions from pornographic exploitation, especially when children are present. To those who would worry about censorship, it has traditionally been carried on by governments in a limited fashion. When I researched this, it goes all the way back to the Spartans and the Romans practiced certain forms of censorship to protect their public. The U.S. Postal Service may refuse to transmit by mail any literature deemed obscene, for example. School books do not contain certain images, and I won't go into what those might be, but we do try to practice restraint in certain areas, and we have done that traditionally as a government. Those who desire to pull up pornographic images are free to do so on their own private computers, but should not use public resources to do so. Let's protect our children from porn. Please pass House Bill 3101. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Before Representative Close leaves, is there, and you're free to stay, I understand, but I figured that you're probably pretty busy and need to go. Are there any questions for Representative Close, Representative Przanski, and then Representative Nelson?
Representative Close, have you received any or asked for any type of LC opinion regarding constitutionality, knowing what we've seen our courts go through on many of the initiatives as well as other bills that have come through previously? I'm wondering if you've got any opinion as to whether we'd be within our constitutional basis under the Oregon Constitution.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Przanski, generally when I have drafted similar bills, I receive an LC letter. I have not done so this time, and so I did not request it. I had assumed that they would include that, as they usually do, if there was a problem.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, good Chair. Representative Close, you know, I am so with you on this, and I stand firmly, and I'm proud of Susan for stepping out and taking this on, too. I think it's awesome for you to do so, and it should not be a controversial issue. I mean, it's just crazy that we term these things as controversial and that it may not pass because it should, and it's
and your
important.
Question is?
My question is, would not the libraries be guilty of, quote, some type of contributing to the delinquency of minors if individuals left that library, like 86% of those do who commit crimes and 56% of those, you know, then thus rape an individual? Wouldn't they be liable for contributing to the delinquency? No different than giving them booze.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Nelson,
drugs.
I think these are the types of issues that, as Representative Przanski indicated, if you pass this type of legislation, it probably does go to a court. It could go all the way to the Supreme Court. And these are the types of issues, then, I think, that would be debated in the court. So I guess one of the purposes of this type of legislation is to get the discussion going and to try to bring those very issues up for debate.
Representative Kitts.
Representative Close, thank you for coming here today. My question is this: I don't understand, and maybe my attorney friend, Representative Przanski, can help me with this with an excellent response. When you deliver or when you develop a one-hour photo, for example, if you're under 18 and the material that is being developed is of sexually graphic nature, they will make a phone call and they will not process that if you're under 18. The Motion Picture of America has to rate their movies and censor who is allowed to see those movies. And I would think that G, PG, R, X, triple X, whatever, there are ratings. And I would classify, and I support this bill, this internet being the same thing, is it not, would it not fall under those same categories? And I don't know if that means that at the library you have an under 18 internet section or you have an over 18 internet section. My question is how is this different and why is this not possible currently without having a law? I mean, if we need a law, fine, but to me it's not censorship because you're still providing the opportunity. You're simply putting parameters of acceptability based on age.
Chair Crummell, Representative Kitts, I think what I would say, and I'm not an attorney, is that you're talking about private business decisions in private industry. And because public libraries are in the public sector, then you get into the free speech rights under the U.S. Constitution. And so that's, you know, and what is free speech and what is obscenity and how far do we go before we put a line there? And as I said, traditionally we have been willing to put a line where obscenity is and try to define that. And in the last 30 years, that has been dissolving. So I believe that's why we need this kind of legislation to establish, again, what is obscenity, what we do to protect our children and our public, and still have free speech rights under the Constitution. I think you can do that. But, again, when it's public money, you know, you get into constitutional issues of free speech.
So, can I follow up for a question?
Follow up.
Yeah.
So, for example, a public library that would no longer carry a book like Huckleberry Finn, as a lot of libraries won't do, which, for that reason, whatever. That's not what I'm debating. Could you not alter the internet as the same, based on the context that's available to the public, under the same type of guidelines that exist for not allowing books into a library? I mean, you don't see Playboy magazine. You see Time magazine, but you don't see Playboy or whatever those other magazines are.
Chair Crummell, Representative Kitts. I think that's an issue for the servers. I know there are other means of dealing with this. There are, I believe there's a boycott right now of Yahoo because they will not filter their sites. They can do so. So I think you will see other forces start to operate in the marketplace, like boycotts, if companies will not be more responsible. I believe that they can be in what they're providing on their internet sites. And you have to shut down the ones that are, what would you call it? Almost like a black market. You have to try to control those types of internet websites.
Well, I tell you why I support this. I'm saddened by it at the same time that it takes legislation to what I would deem common sense.
Thank you.
It's common sense.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions for Representative Close? Representative, thank you very much. Ms. Rich, go ahead, if you would, please.
Well, thank you for hearing my testimony. And it's kind of a repeat of what's been said, except I am coming from...
Maybe you could just tell us what the differences are, and then that way we can...
do that. Okay. I'm not. First off, I'm not anti-library. I have library background training, and I have pleasant memories of libraries and my time and my children's time. But times are changing, and my reason for submitting this bill are really pretty simple. This is not the same world we live in as when those libraries that we knew existed. The internet changed our lives, and we need to deal with the problems it is creating in addition to the benefits we have experienced. Libraries used to accept a moral responsibility for the protection of children, but due to changes in the ALA policies around 1972, this trust was broken, and parents are becoming increasingly alarmed at what pornographic materials can be accessed at the public library. Many libraries provide filtering out of material harmful to the children, but many insist that would be censorship. It is not censorship. It is common sense. The plain truth is, if you were caught downloading the same material in your home or distributing it outside the library, you could be arrested. And a sad commentary on our library system. The link between child pornography and child abductions and murders is also well documented, and it must stop. Many sex offenders now cruise the internet instead of the playgrounds. It is reported that one in every 20 homes houses a sex offender, per statistics on the Oprah show a few weeks ago, where she had a sexual predator who had spent 10 years in prison, and he was trying to justification. What he was doing was trying to apologize to the victims. When he moved into a neighborhood, he went to the neighbors, told them who he was and what everything, and his theory, they would monitor him, you know. But he admitted that it was an addiction that was never cured. And that was it was really chilling. In a summation, all we are asking is that the library provide the same internet protection for children that other venues provide regarding alcohol, tobacco, the ratings on movies, etc. We don't believe that is too much to ask. And thank you for your consideration on that. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Are there any?
Tons of everything. And another element, too, is some libraries have been sued now under Title VII because librarians have had enough of having to deal with all the things they're running into, helping people access internet pornography. And it's the Minnesota 12, so you might want to watch that. That's there are some real case things going on now. And there are 14 states now that are currently pursuing legal, internet filtering because they're not going to wait to see what the Supreme Court does.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to have Marie Hyde, Paul Hyde, and Lou Barris come up as another panel. And Lou, I don't know if we're going to have time for your film. Is it a brief video? Or
it's a brief video from 700 Club there. Has Malcolm McConaughey and so forth.
Well, let's let the Hydes go first, and then we can see.
I could go my comments, and Ellie's going to have the video there.
Lou, you're not bringing examples of internet porn in here, are you?
You already had it.
Welcome to Marie Hyde, who also is a 2001 Oregon's 2002, excuse me, I stand corrected, Oregon's Mother of the Year.
All right.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Marie, why don't you go ahead and start?
Okay. And that is an honor, but the greatest honor for me is the fact that I am a wife and a mother, and I'm a grandmother. And I've worked with children since I was 14 years old. And I recognize the vulnerability of children. And we're in America, we have reached a unique situation that we've never before been faced with. Our youth have money, and they have time on their hands. And we have so many who are living in homes where both parents are working, or maybe they have their single parent families and the parent is not working. So they have unsupervised time also. And so I think, you know, when they say it takes a village to raise a child, I think we need to look at that. It takes our community to raise these children now, and we need to provide safety nets for them, because if we don't, they will fall prey. There are people who prey upon them. And a person who was working for the tobacco company testified that when they sat down in their business meetings, it was like, how can we raise our sales? And it was always target the youth. And I cannot see that pornography is going to be any different. You target the youth because you get them hooked in, and then you've got them hooked for life. I think the American Library Association can do a lot of good, and I think it does, but I wonder if it hasn't lost its perspective. And I won't go through all of this that I handed out, but I highlighted some areas there. And some of the, particularly on page 39, some of the things they've done, and we have to recognize that not only does the pornography industry help fund the American Library Association, but ALA President Ann Simons has served on the Playboy Foundation's Awards Committee. Playboy Executive Christy Hefner was a forum panelist in the ALA convention. And the bottom line always comes down to this official policy statement of the American Library Association. Libraries acting within their mission and objectives must support access to information on all subjects that serve the needs of or interests of each user, regardless of the user's age or the content of the material. And I think that it would be wonderful if the American Library Association would reevaluate and look at the part they could play in our society. Porn, as it was mentioned out, pornography is like dry rot. And if any of you have ever had dry rot, you know that it works from within. And so much damage is done before you ever realize you have it. And this is what's happening. And we have good families that don't realize some of their families already involved. One thing highlighted some places, but one thing I'd like to share with you. Lady Margaret Thatcher spoke at a university, 7 years ago here in America. And she brought out that America is the only country in the world actually founded on liberty, the only one. And that the founding fathers journeyed here not to make a fortune, but to worship God. And by their example, to perpetuate freedom and justice more widely, it began with them. There can be no freedom or liberty without a rule of law, because otherwise, as you know, it would be the freedom of the strong to oppress the weak. And this is what I see happening. The strong financially, the strong who have the financial backing, oppress the weak, who don't have the time to have developed wisdom and experience and knowledge in their life. And this, we have these youth that have the money and the time, but they haven't had a chance to develop good judgment and so forth. This is the time when they should be learning and be taught. She mentions freedom has responsibilities as well. Some people are taking the freedom and leaving the responsibilities. The values and virtues we prize are honesty, self-discipline, a sense of responsibility to one's family, to one's country. And she said, in the West here, it shows that these qualities are threatened by our lack of respect for the rights, freedom, and property of others, and thought for others. And I think that if you will read through this information that I've highlighted so I can give time to others, but the back page here, the number is under the staple. But cyber porn held responsible for increase in sex addiction and addiction. Cyber sex is the crack cocaine of sexual addiction. It works so quickly and it's so instantly intense. It has exploded because it's of its perceived anonymity, whatever that is, my mouth's so dry, the speed of accessing material and the affordability. It's so easy to get to. Please read through this. It states what we need to know. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Paul?
Thank you. I'll try to be focused and brief. I'm here as a father and a grandfather. I know the destructiveness of pornography. It's erosive, it's corrosive, it's addictive, and it's destructive. I have 7 children and 11 grandchildren. I have filtered what my children see as they grew up, my 7 children. My 7 children now filter for themselves, and they're now filtering for their children. But the lack of filters in a public library can be harmful to those who do not understand the destructive nature of pornography and the availability of it that is so easy. There are those who wonder about filters and the principle of freedom of expression. I liken pornography to termites. Termites that attack the timbers of decency, wisdom, marriages, families, cultures, and societies. Now, when termites enter your home or attack the supporting structures of a meaningful facility, do the termites have freedom? Do they have a right to attack? And then does the homeowner have the right to hire or employ a termite exterminator? Where's the rights? Where's the privileges? Where's the responsibility? Where's the wisdom? Where's the judgment? And so I would just conclude by saying, as a father, as a grandfather, as a taxpayer that is grateful that he can support through his taxes the public library, I can remember my first time going to a library when my mother, 60 years ago, took me to a library for the first time. The joy, the meaningfulness that one. We've transported that to our children, and now it's thrilling to see our grandchildren go. I want them to be safe from termites. And the only way to keep termites out is through filters. And that's my intent, my desire, my hope, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman Crummel and representatives. My name is Lou Barris. I'm Executive Director of Christian Coalition.
You'll share.
Okay. My name's Lou Barris, Executive Director of Christian Coalition, and some people consider me one of these moral maniacs, but I don't know. I don't think I fit in that category. But I believe I want to come to you as this. It is good public policy to filter libraries from the pornography and the filth that comes over. So I look at it as good government policy, public policy, and also that community standards. I know in Oak Grove we have some of these new dancing and so forth, but there's close to schools and so forth. So it's good, and they closed it down because there's good community standards. And I believe that we in Oregon, we want a name of good community standards. In some areas of our state, especially north of here, into a large county, has a name that's not as pleasing to what the rest of Oregon believes. So I hope they don't influence our community as much as they should. I believe we as citizens of Oregon want good and wholesome policies. We want community standards that does no harm for our children and grandchildren. I have 4 children. I have 12 grandchildren. And let me tell you, you should have your grandchildren before you have your children.
I've heard that one before.
Yeah, that's, and when you're there, you'll believe it, you know. But I'm also, my son-in-law is Damon Coates, the sheriff that was shot. And he's doing very well, by the way. And so I'm looking at how important those children are who are taking over some of that responsibility now since he is laid up. And so it's up to even grandparents to help with what's going on in our society. Here's a chart. I just want to show you real quick a chart from the librarians. It's impressive because a survey shows that public librarians and school librarians are highly satisfied with filters. It says an impressive 90% of public librarians who use filters respond that the software serves its purpose either well or very well, and it's been increasing 90%. That's impressive on that, and also in support of H House Bill 3101. And this is probably strong language, but this is I believe the Oregon legislature has the duty and responsibility to protect the public health and welfare of our citizenships, mostly particular children and grandchildren. And I believe it's good public policy. The Internet offers many educational benefits and useful technology tools for access to a vast selection of information. The Internet, unfortunately, contains material that's not constitutionally protected. This is not constitutionally protected and is illegal to disseminate, such as child pornography, sadomasochism, and I don't know how to spell it here or pronounce it, but sex with dead and bestiality and all the other things. I don't even want to say some of these things. Pornography is the most assessed topic on the Internet according to two-year research, Alexa research study. The FBI has identified the Internet as a leading factor in doubling the children's sex exploitation caseload in 1 year and is a primary solicitation tool used by pedophiles and entice children into improper relationships. Pornography is linked to sex offenses, and also there's a court cases in your packet there. And there are also funds available for the challenge program through the government. So there's a number of things that we could look at this pornography issue. But I'm looking at it as a grandparent. I'm looking at it as a parent. And by being against these Internet filters, you know, in the library, we are, in effect, promoting pornography to our kids. Pornography in Lake Oswego area, they have filters. We worked on a few years ago. They're working. And in the final thing, this will be an issue. I don't know if I make any difference to anybody here, but in our voter guide on a Christian coalition line, because I believe as we have tens of thousands of people in this state interested in the family, and so this is an issue that we get called on all the time. So I believe that it's in the best interest of our state to put filters on a pornography for our libraries. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, let me have Nanheim and Andrea Myers. Can I have you both come up at the same time, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Library Association, in opposition to House Bill 3101. Our organization has approximately 1,000 members who are board members, staff, and members of friends organizations of all types of libraries throughout the state of Oregon. We are a very diverse group. And in our discussions on this issue, one concern has emerged as our main concern, and that is that this bill would preempt local control of this issue. For the last several years, public libraries throughout the state have been wrestling to put together local policies on computer usage and Internet access. For many of these libraries, the process has been long, painstaking, well covered by local media, involving taxpayers, all types of library users, parents, students, etc. The resulting policies reflect the local community's desires, and that is how we believe it should be done. The policy, for example, adopted in Lake County is very different from the policy adopted by the Wilsonville Public Library. And that, in turn, is very different from the policy adopted for the Eugene Public Library. These policies vary from community to community. Oregonians love their public libraries in this state. We are proud of the fact that we rank number 2 in the nation among the states for per capita checking out of books from public libraries. Local support has generally been very good. Public libraries are often the heart of their communities, and that is where we believe these decisions should be made. I should mention another concern, and that has emerged recently, and that is the cost. I understand that there's been a fiscal impact estimate on this bill of about $500,000. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll make sure I'm not, there's a lot of back feed on this. Chair Crummell, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We believe that House Bill 3101, if it were passed, would be found to violate both the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, as well as the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, because it would block access to constitutionally protected speech. This proposal imposes a classic system of prior restraint that presumptively violates the First Amendment. And the language of the bill as drafted is wholly undefined in terms of what offensive material would be. Now, and as such, it becomes a content-based restriction. The courts find those presumptively invalid. Now, libraries are truly a marketplace of ideas. American libraries have always been a great equalizer, providing books and other information resources to help people of all ages and backgrounds to live, learn, work, and govern in a democratic society. Today, more than ever, our nation's libraries are vibrant, are multicultural institutions that connect people in the smallest and most remote communities with global information resources, particularly because of the advance of communications through the Internet. Statistics show that library internets are accessed by a high percentage of low-income people who would otherwise not have access to the World Wide Web. And I quote from the Special District Court out of Pennsylvania on the case that's now before the U.S. Supreme Court. Of the 143 million Americans using the Internet, approximately 10% access the Internet at a public library. Internet access at public libraries is more often used by those with lower incomes than those with higher incomes. About 20% of Internet users with household family incomes of less than $15,000 per year use our public libraries for Internet access. Now, in addition, the Internet has been clearly designated by the court and the highest court as protected free speech. Ruling unanimously in Reno versus ACLU, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1996 declared the Internet to be a free speech zone, deserving of at least as much First Amendment protection as that afforded to books, newspapers, and magazines. The government, the court said, can no more restrict a person's access to words or images over the Internet than it could be allowed to snatch a book out of a reader's hands or cover over a statue of a nude in a museum. The nine justices in Reno were clearly persuaded by the unique nature of the medium itself. The Internet, it said, is the most participatory form of mass speech yet developed, entitled to the highest protection from government intrusion. The Internet is like a vast library including millions of readily available and indexed publications, the content of which is as diverse as human thought. Now, what we're talking about here is filtering software, and the bottom line is it does not work. Blocking programs do not and cannot distinguish between protected and unprotected speech, nor can they block access to all of or only that speech on the Internet that this bill proposes to block. The web contains an unimaginable number of documents. I mean, you read statistics of about 5 years ago, and they were in the millions, and now they're in the billions. There are approximately 1.5 million pages added to the publicly indexable web each day. Because of the ease with which material can be added, the content of existing websites is constantly changing. Most blocking software prevents access to sites based on criteria, and these software developers, these corporate businesses, private parties, refuse to say what criteria they are using to block particular sites because they consider that proprietary business information. So not only does this bill represent the worst kind of government censorship, but it would end up delegating to non-governmental actors to decide and then censor what we read, see, and hear without revealing to anyone what criteria they're using. I want to take a moment to read a few examples of things that, with filtering like sex or adult content, gets wrapped up into a block and you would not have access to it. They have erroneously, let me get to the,
the Knights of Columbus Council, a Catholic men's group associated with St. Patrick's Church in Fallon, Nevada, was blocked because it, by adult sexually explicit category. The home of the Lesbian and Gay Havarah of the Long Beach, California Jewish Community Center was blocked with adults-only pornography filter. The Orphanage Emmanuel, a Christian orphanage in Honduras that houses 225 adult children, was blocked as adult sexually explicit. Vision Art Online, which sells wooden wall hangings for the home that contains prayers, passages from the Bible, and images of the Star of David, was also blocked because of a sex category. Tenzin Bao Palmo, a Buddhist nun, had a site which contained a description of her project to build a Buddhist nunnery, an international retreat center. What was the category it got blocked under? Nudity. Several block sites also contain information about governmental entities or specific political candidates. And I will just, one was a libertarian candidate. The Wisconsin Right to Life was blocked for nudity. A federal site that, a site that promotes federalism in Uganda, adults only, pornography. And then we get in the whole area of health issues. And relating and sites that get blocked. Many sites with questions about health care, Columbia University site, a Western Amputee Support Alliance homepage was blocked for pornography. A site dealing with halitosis was blocked as adult-only pornography by one site, sex by another, and adult sexually explicit by another. They also, these filtering programs also block several websites having to do with education and careers. Homeschooling often is getting targeted as adult and sexually explicit. A site for dentists, same criteria. The filtering programs have blocked web travel sites, a bed and breakfast, adult content. Southern Alberta flying fishing outfitters were pornography. And then finally, sports. Willie O'Ree, the first African-American player in the National Hockey League, that was nudity filter. The University Australian Football Club was both adult pornography, sex, sexually explicit, and sex. I have to throw in a few other examples that I found. www.thestrippers.com.
Actually, Andrea, we fully get the point of what you're trying to say. Okay. That there have been, and I understand from a standpoint of the web developers and software developers and some of the issues that they have in terms of trying to figure out how these filters are going to work.
And Chair Crum, I appreciate it because the whole flaw of this, the house upon which any of these things are being built and the premise of safety and security for our children or anyone is really sadly a false premise that is undone by the inability of these filtering systems to actually block out things that some of the proponents would want to block out, and it doesn't in many cases, but it sweeps in. For the record, the strippers.com was a wood varnishing removal service. just didn't want them to be left there hanging with that. And in addition, in Oregon in the last 10 years, voters have rejected three attempts to limit what they can read, see, and hear, the most recent in 2002. Now, briefly, the case law, most recently a federal special panel in May 2002, decisively rejected Congress's latest attempt at library internet censorship, the Children Internet Protection Act. Based on 9 days of testimony from librarians, patrons, web publishers, and experts, the court supported its ruling with over 100 pages, and let me assure you, it's over 100 pages, of detailed findings of fact, obviously from which I just cited those websites, which established that at least tens of thousands of web pages are wrongly blocked by programs. The court wrote that any filter program that blocks enough speech to protect against the visual depictions that are obscene and harmful to minors will necessarily overblock substantial amounts of speech that do not fall within those categories. In evaluating the constitutionality of the law, the court does apply the strictest scrutiny. The court wrote the argument that protected speech may be banned as a means to ban unprotected speech turns the First Amendment upside down. The government may not suppress lawful speech as a means to suppress unlawful speech. Bottom line is we believe that this bill is unconstitutional, and it turns librarians into the thought police armed with, at a minimum, clumsy, ineffective blocking programs, and we urge you to reject this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. At some risk, I'm going to ask if there's any questions. Representative Mabry, and then Representative Kipps.
Well, I, you know, the responding to local control, you know, we restrict who consumes alcohol, who drives an automobile, who takes tobacco, who can even serve themselves gasoline in this state. And I could go on and on and on without half trying. And that's not... we don't allow local control to determine those things. And we're talking about our children. I, too, have had the experience of having someone... Well, I've had the experience of looking for something on the net, not being able to find it. And yeah, that's frustrating. And I don't have a filter on them. I just don't know how to find things. But I've also had the experience of someone saying, have you seen the new website for the Columbia Basin Nursing Home in Adels, Oregon? And I said, no. And they said, do this, this, this. And as soon as I hit Columbia Basin Nursing Home, I got a porn site. I was shocked. They thought that was funny. They trapped me. And I hit the delete button, and another one appeared, and another one appeared, and another one appeared. And I think I went through 10 or 12 or 14 sites before that happened. So the point being, I've searched for things and couldn't find them, but I didn't have any trouble at all finding a porn site at a Columbia Basin nursing home. So my question, I wouldn't debate constitutionality with you, because I'm not an attorney and I don't pretend to be, but... My question is, I've been to a library, I've needed something, I couldn't find it, I went to the desk, they said, oh, we'll have to get that for you. And I didn't have any problem. It wasn't pornography, by the way. It was research material, but they had to get it for me. But if we put filters on these computers that have access to everyone with the potential for the override, mm-hmm. and if I come to you and say, you know, I want to see some of these dirty movies, would you override that for me? What is unconstitutional about that?
Chair Crummell, Representative Mabry, the court indeed has said that that's even a more chilling effect to require that someone get approval, to go to someone else to get approval to look at it. And so they would still apply the strict scrutiny. You're still limiting access to speech. Someone has to go and ask for it. I, too, have had many problems finding what I'm looking for on the web, and so you and I can both work together to figure out how to access what we're looking for. But that would be, according to the court and the analysis, I mean, the same analysis, strict scrutiny to whether it's permissible would apply. And I don't know, Nan, if you can speak to the librarians' experiences in wanting to be the gatekeepers to decide. And they don't have to approve it or not. It becomes you then turn it over to a government official to decide who and what can see what. And that's, again, impermissible.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, a couple of comments. One is that public libraries in the state are more than 99% funded by local taxpayer money, which is one reason we feel strongly that those policies should be set at the local level. I have talked to a number of librarians in the state in the past few days, some of whom have filters in their libraries, and the most interesting comment, I think, was that the ones who can figure out how to dismantle the filters are, in fact, children. In terms of use of the computers to get to pornography, librarians don't like the role of being gatekeepers, but in fact they are constantly, not constantly because I don't think it happens that much, but when there is a patron looking at pornography, there's a tap on the shoulder and it's stopped.
I just remark, you know, people can get in my car too, but that doesn't prevent me from putting a lock on it. I find that unacceptable personally.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kitts, and then Representative Nelson.
Andrew, God bless you in this day and age. You don't have an easy job. From flag burning to child pornography, you got to defend them all.
A fun time on your committee.
I would do not envy you. My question is this, is that realizing Article 1, Section 8 may be a violation, or as I've been told by people outside in my conversation, it's a blatant violation. Okay? That being said, Would we get around that if, in fact, we required the libraries, for example, to have two separate sections, i.e., one for over 18
and one for under 18, because isn't there a provision for what, you know, for the same statute that protects the one-hour photo example that I gave earlier, to protect children from these sorts of things? Would that not be an acceptable compromise to get around the constitutionality of the issue as written?
Chair Kummel, Representative Kitts, you know, I don't know the one-hour photo requirement. I suspect what you're talking about is a requirement if you suspect that there's child abuse going on, that you report it, which, as, of course, many of us have as a requirement. And that's not the same situation here, that we're talking about a far, far more expansive world of content than the suspicion that there's actually child abuse going on. As to setting up a filter in one place and not in another, or different. I mean, the two hurdles you run into is, first of all, the definition, particularly under the Oregon Constitution, but even under the federal Constitution, the definition of what is going to be filtered is so broad, and leaves it to the discretion. It's entirely undefined. It's unmanageable, and as such, it becomes a content-based restriction that is going to sweep in permissible speech, no matter what age and the maturity level of someone. And that gets you to the filtering systems, which are wholly inadequate. And so you still get back to the court looking at it. Is the process in which you are actually engaged in the filtering of stopping the speech from coming in narrowly tailored and limited to get to that particular type of speech? And the answer is, technology-wise, not even close.
15-second follow-up. Nan, thanks for coming here today, and please don't, I hope neither of you perceive my question as being hostile. Are there any districts that you can name that would support, you said all districts are different, can you name one district that would support having child pornography in the library?
No.
Thank you.
I cannot.
That was pretty close. That's pretty good.
Well, once I saw that you were timing, then I really...
Representative Kummel, Representative Kitts, just for the record, this statute, is so far broader than child pornography. And I just wanted to make clear that...
And also, for the record, I would also note that I think that the motive behind this is that of a good nature to our kids, be it pornography, be it bestiality. I don't want, you know, and these people are sickos. And I'll say it for the record, and I'll defend it any day of the week. It's sick. And if I can keep children from seeing some of this stuff, I'm going to try my darndest, so you know.
Your 15 seconds are now up, and Representative Nelson's 15 seconds are beginning.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, Mr. Chair, that there are some things, some men, some women, some actions that are evil in this world, and they require extermination or termination. And one of them, for example, was the bill we passed, completely signed by the governor in the last session, to prevent bullying in school. That restricted, you know, someone's right to expression, but it was the right thing to do. So I think we need to ask ourselves, what is right? Local control, I'm for local control. But the point is, if you're not doing anything, you know, about a situation that contributes to evil, what are we doing? And we can use all sorts of excuses, but I'd like to think that we're going to do what's right for those children, and that's to protect them from evil.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson and Representative Kitts, I want to point out that both the McMinnville Library and the Hillsborough Library do have local policies with filtering for children.
And I'm so grateful.
Somehow I have the suspicion that the courts wouldn't prohibit us from filtering out halitosis.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to thank the committee for your indulgence on us going way over time, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3101. And I'm going to, on the other House, two bills that we have before us, 3062 and 3060, we will reschedule those for another day. And so with nothing else before us, we will stand adjourned.